Ground Cover News is a nonprofit street paper that was founded in April 2010 as a means to empower low-income persons to make the transitions from homeless to housed and from jobless to employed. Vendors purchase each copy of the Ground Cover News regular edition at our office for 50 cents. This money goes towards production costs. Vendors work selling the paper on the street for $2, keeping all income and tips from each sale. This audio production was made possible by the Ann Arbor District Library, recorded at Fifth Avenue Studios. If you consistently enjoy Ground Cover Speaks, continuing to buy physical newspapers from Ground Cover vendors ensures that we can sustain production. The physical paper and in-person interaction is at the heart of our work. You can find the link to our next audio recording in the upcoming print issue of Ground Cover News. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to our print advertisers, the People's Food Co-op, St. Francis of Assisi Parish, First Baptist Church, Bethlehem United Church of Christ, the Office of Community and Economic Development, Cineholic, Art on a Journey, Ann Arbor for Public Power, Four Directions, and the Ypsilanti Food Co-op.
Winter's leaves. The dancing silhouettes of songbirds high in my tree break my reverie. Evening sun catching beaks bright orange, orange again through their wings. Animated stained glass in the lofty reaches of my cathedral. Gently, sporadically, life's choir's chords escape down to me through the cacophony of pandemonium's howling autos. Winter's leaves perched upon winter's skeletal tree. They group together seemingly pointlessly. A glance away and they are gone. Evidence of them, only the weight in my chest abated, serenity bestowed, and words, as life's prophet, I'm compelled to write, those feelings fleeting as winter's leaves.
Everything Fits, Monique Caldwell, Ground Cover contributor. I love you for the way you study the world, how your presence softens the noise inside me. You are the warmth to my winter morning, the anchor to my restless tide, the steady flame to my wandering wick. You are the harmony to my melody, the shoreline to my returning waves, the open sky that teaches my hope to rise. You are the honey to my tea, gentle, certain, perfectly blended, the compass to my journey, the quiet truth to my searching, the laughter to my long days. Loving you feels like recognition, as if my spirit remembers yours, from a place beyond memory. With you, everything fits.
YouTube Core increases access and transparency, violates privacy. Marie, Ground Cover contributor. Over the new year, a local resident served as a catalyst for this writer to investigate the current climate of using Zoom and YouTube for court. The resident sought community support with a cyberstalking situation following personal information being shared via YouTube during landlord-tenant court. The stalker was sending pictures, personal information, and messages claiming they had seen the resident on YouTube court and were offering help. A peer provided assistance, mitigating the situation by helping the resident change privacy settings on their social media accounts and blocking unwanted contact. According to the Michigan Judicial Council, MJC, transparency and public access live streaming policies, rules, workgroup report, and recommendations, July 2023, there are several situations when information is considered protected and should not be broadcast, which includes, but is not limited to, information often shared during landlord-tenant proceedings and cases involving vulnerable stakeholders. The MJC is a 29-member panel established in 2021 by the Michigan Supreme Court, MSC, responsible for planning strategically for the Michigan Judicial Branch, MJB, enhancing the work of the courts and making recommendations to the MSC on matters pertinent to the administration of justice. After speaking with numerous local community members, who all be referred to as Buddy to maintain anonymity, watching several YouTube court posts, and reviewing accessible information from the MJB, a pattern emerged, suggesting some overlapping viewpoints about the benefits and weaknesses of Michigan's current internet court trends. For those who have internet access, attending court online or utilizing online court services saves time and reduces the cost burden associated with court activities. For many, online court access raises concerns related to privacy and decorum. For others, the use of live streaming aids research and observation of courtrooms across the country. The basics of online court. The concept of conducting court business with the aid of the internet is not a brand new concept. All courts at this time have a website where information may be obtained and forms accessed. Zoom court, or remote participation via the Zoom platform, has been around for many years, especially in areas where travel to courthouses is lengthy. The MSC's Task Force on Open Courts, Media, and Privacy final report, dated December 2021, defines Zoom court as participating in a court proceeding online via video conference without physically being in a brick-and-mortar courthouse. In addition, courts in Michigan use YouTube to live stream proceedings to accommodate observation, not participation, by the public. When COVID-19 hit, a major internet transition occurred when courts began live streaming judicial proceedings via YouTube and using Zoom for remote participation became the norm. YouTube court refers to the ability to view activities occurring in a courtroom either live or via posted recording. The MSC's 2021 final report states, "To preserve access to our courts, parties and their counsel were generally allowed to participate in proceedings remotely. To preserve the transparency of our courts, those proceedings were streamed online using a variety of platforms. Judicial transparency is the idea that the public should be able to observe and receive information regarding judicial proceedings, including through media coverage. To promote transparency, proceedings may be streamed online. Judicial access is the idea that those who need recourse to judicial proceedings should be able to obtain it. To preserve access to court participation, parties and their counsel may be allowed to participate using the internet." Positions on internet court. The rules surrounding the use of internet for court appear to be a work in progress. And according to the 2023 MJC report, providing live online streaming access is no longer mandatory. Both the MJB and the community express ongoing concerns, including misuse of court proceedings made available online, monetizing live streaming as evidenced by advertising, and violations of privacy. The MJC Council presented the following list of stakeholders who require special shielding in all courtrooms: protection of children and vulnerable adults, protection of crime victims and witnesses, preventing disclosure of sensitive financial details, protecting privacy interests of parties, and protecting privacy interests of jurors. A 2023 recommendation from the MJC suggests establishing guidelines for trial courts for the use of live streaming, which include protections for stakeholders, especially those who are vulnerable, throughout the process, as well as informing stakeholders in attendance about live streaming prior to being streamed. Amidst ethical issues and concerns about constitutional rights, Michigan is utilizing procedures common in most states. Currently, the State Court Administrator's Office, Michigan Trial Court's Virtual Courtroom Standards and Guidelines, dated April 7, 2020, encourages the creation of a YouTube channel if a court does not have one. While YouTube.com provides more information about how the platform operates, a channel with about 1,000 subscribers is eligible for monetization through advertising. The MSC Task Force report from 2021 suggests not utilizing a platform that has ads, and ads are among the options for monetizing YouTube channels. Task Force concerns about ads at a minimum acknowledges a monetized incentive for live streaming court proceedings. Using a monetized platform was identified as a conflict of interest by some stakeholders as it places profit or finances over the rights of people in the justice system. At this time, whether the court system is earning any money is unclear. Investigations to gain clarity around monetization are ongoing. Public comment. Dozens of community members were approached and/or observed via the internet while conducting research for this article. Perspectives presented cover many judicial stakeholders, yet they do not represent all positions nor every population impacted by the justice system. While some of the following real-life examples were transcribed in real time, many community members were engaged in a less formal interview format with notes written afterward. Buddy One didn't know their court proceedings would be streamed. I had no clue I was going to be on YouTube. The housing unit in the jail told me I was on the news. Judge has a YouTube channel, and it was probably going to be on there. It's BS the way they will exploit a person. Buddy One also shared negative consequences of being on YouTube as embarrassment and public humiliation. The judge kept egging me on. He's supposed to be a professional. On the positive side, they said, I have a good rapport with the judge now. I'm not going to smart off to a judge again. I learned a lesson. Buddy Two shared they have never been in trouble to the extent they had to appear in court, but I would not want to be broadcast. It's wrong and a violation of privacy. Buddy Three shared a story where they assisted a person who escaped a sexual assault and were coerced into testifying as a witness. While this buddy's experience occurred prior to Zoom and YouTube court practices being implemented, they described testifying as traumatic as they felt attacked while testifying and would not want the experience to be broadcast. Buddy Four stated, I don't agree with that at all. I didn't know that they broadcast on YouTube. It is public knowledge. The public has a right to know about criminals. But with that said, it doesn't mean I want to be on YouTube. It wasn't meant to be the way people use it. Buddy Five said, it's the age we live in. It's the freedom of information, FOIA. It's the age of social media. Buddy Six said, it shows what kind of fraud they is. All the system is money. Buddy Seven said, it's the First Amendment and Fifth Amendment. It's FOIA. I see it as content, but with that said, I wouldn't want to be on YouTube court. YouTube is how a lot of people get their news now. After they get 1,000 subscribers, they monetize it. Buddy Eight. Zoom court has saved my life, but it shouldn't be something that anybody can access and monetize. There should be oversight. Buddy Nine, typically, I think it's horrible. This guy was having a horrible time and people are laughing. It's not funny. It speaks to the popularity of true crime. If I was in court and I wanted my support system to be there, but couldn't be there physically, it could have a function. Buddy Ten, I think the court system should be abolished. I'm not comfortable with it. YouTube court. I think they play to the camera. Buddy 11. Law teacher at school uses it. They show the live courtroom to the students to show how the court system works. Buddy 12. It's effed up. They, the police, profiled me off that. We know what you're in court for because I got in trouble. It's supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. Now it's guilty until proven guilty. Buddy 13, COVID brought it to light when everything went virtual. YouTube is broadly used in a way to embarrass people, and I don't like it. I don't like all the viral, stressful, emotional, hard on public display for entertainment. Different people have different comfortable ability. People have a right to view. Using it as entertainment, I am personally in disagreement with. There are sensitive issues. People are going through things, using their plate for entertainment. Buddy 14, I don't think you should be allowed to put a very private, intimate, life-altering experience out for display like reality TV. Mental shame and anguish. People haven't even been given due process. It robs them of a sense of justice that they can participate in justice fairly. Buddy 15 clarified they didn't know they were being broadcast. It's 21st century modern times and everything. So to some extent, things are recorded. What I couldn't imagine in a million years is that it would be taken into a public domain so quickly and publicly. It's a lucrative content-making opportunity off of parading people around like legal Jerry Springer. And unlike talk shows, real outcomes with real cases, real lives affected forever. The bottom line is there is money to be made from this content. And as long as that's the case, we will keep seeing these types of exploitative practices. Like with everything, the internet could be used for good or bad. It streams like bottlenecks that have long been there, but there is a cost to people's safety and privacy. COVID-19 launched a permanent post-pandemic court. COVID-19 launched a permanent shift to rely more heavily on internet access to court business. However, concerns remain about how current practices balance constitutional rights. At this time, courts rely heavily on state court administrators' offices' 2020 guidelines and standards. While the guidelines explicitly state Zoom and YouTube are not the only acceptable platforms, the directions do explain how to utilize them. In 2023, the MJC recommended SCAO add updates to the standards and guidelines for live streaming settings to decrease trauma. A recent review of Washtenaw County judges listed on the MyCourt virtual courtroom directory suggests not all Washtenaw County courtrooms currently have a working YouTube link, nor do all judges with a working link have the 1,000 subscriber threshold for monetization. The judges without a YouTube link and those with fewer subscribers appear to handle a larger load of cases relating to protected and vulnerable populations, such as juveniles, families, personal protection orders, and specialty court. However, an inspection of the MyCourt virtual courtroom directory and the Washtenaw.org indicates that both state and county information about courtrooms and judges sometimes need updating. At this time, a FOIA request is in progress with the goal of gaining clarification surrounding whether courtrooms have monetized live streaming and how the revenue is being utilized. According to a Michigan Courts news release from November 6, 2025, written by John Nevin, titled A New Era for Michigan's Trial Courts, Transformative Funding Model Proposed, efforts are underway to change court funding, aiming to eliminate financial conflicts of interest, ensure fair and stable funding, and expand equitable access to justice for all Michiganders. In the release is a summary suggesting a framework taken from India's experiences, published in the Legal Youngster and titled Judicial Transparency Versus Privacy, an analysis of live streaming court proceedings. In the article, Gupta says a judiciary's credibility lies on public confidence, which hinges on transparency and accountability. Safeguards and recommendations follow. Selective streaming, which only streams proceedings involving constitutional interpretation, public interest litigation, and significant legal questions, with cases involving family, vulnerable populations, or sexual offenses excluded. 2, anonymization and blurring measures to protect identity. 3, content regulation, where a time delay may be utilized to filter inappropriate or confidential material. 4, training and sensitization for judges, lawyers, and court staff to handle streamed proceedings with decorum and professionalism. 5, technological infrastructure that includes secure and high-quality audiovisual equipment for smooth streaming. 6, legal framework that provides clear guidelines, data protection principles, and penalization of misusing content. 7, archives and accessibility for recording storage on official judicial portals with metadata categorization and public access tools. Part of Gupta's conclusion states live streaming has the potential to revolutionize public engagement with the legal system, enhance legal education, and promote institutional accountability. However, the enthusiasm for openness must be tempered with a cautious understanding of its repercussions. Making improvements to the justice system is in progress, and it is possible for Michigan courts to improve access, maintain transparency, protect privacy, and even achieve MSC's goal of making our justice system a model for the nation.
Two recent local injustices reveal law enforcement overreach. Two violent incidents within 48 hours involving Washtenaw County and city police have residents questioning whether law enforcement has become militarized. Many in the community look towards a nonviolent crisis response to neighborhood instead of law enforcement to mitigate harm. January 4th and January 5th, 2026, in Ypsilanti, Michigan, law enforcement used what many thought was unnecessary force to remove a person having a mental health crisis. The next day, an unarmed individual who still hasn't been identified was shot and killed by Washtenaw County Sheriff deputies. The siege on January 4th and 5th involved the combined police force of Ypsilanti Eastern Michigan, Washtenaw County, Livingston County, Plymouth, Howe, Hamburg Township, and Shawnee County, the state of Michigan police and Washtenaw County SWAT, who surrounded an Ypsilanti resident for 30 hours because he had a sword at his own place of residency. See Ground Cover News, January 9, 2026 edition. Reuben Pillar, 53, is still in the hospital but may be facing numerous of felony charges. Pending charges are unknown while Pillar remains in the hospital custody because he has still not been arraigned. January 20th, 20 Ypsilanti residents spoke in support of the Resolution 2026-18, a resolution condemning the militarized policing siege on West Cross Street, calling for all charges to be dropped and demanding inmate systematic reform, introduced by Council Member Amber Fellows, Ward 3. The resolution didn't pass, see Ground Cover News, January 23, 2026 edition. On February 3rd, Ypsilanti City Council voted to delay the proposed Police Advisory Commission review of the Ypsilanti Police Department rule in the incident. One day after the standoff, early the next morning, January 6th, a driver was shot and killed by the Washtenaw County Sheriff Deputy after fleeing and crashing in Ypsilanti. Initial authorities said the driver was armed, but later said no weapon was in the vehicle. January 22, 2026, authorities in Washtenaw County released dash cam footage of the deputy-involved shooting. The footage showed the chase and the shooting that left the unarmed driver dead after multiple deputies opened fire on the vehicle. The deputies-involved shooting happened on the corner of Michigan Ave and Prospect Road. Soon after the release of the dash cam video, the family of the victim of the deputy-involved shooting announced their plans to sue the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office for wrongful death. This is a fatal OK Corral shooting of a man that did not have a gun, nor did he pose a threat of great bodily harm or immense danger as far as physical harm to another, said Todd Flood, a Detroit-based lawyer. It should have never taken place, reported M Live. Flood said he's representing the estate of the 34-year-old St. Clair's man who was killed by Washtenaw County Sheriff's deputy on January 6th. The man has not yet been identified. Four deputies are on administrative leave and are under investigation and will remain under administration leave while the Michigan State Police conduct their investigation, said Washtenaw County Sheriff Alicia M. Dyer. Law enforcement refers to a government authority, agency, and personnel such as police, federal agents, and sheriff deputies responsible for maintaining public safety and order. These entities investigate, detain suspects, enforce laws and property. Their core function is to ensure compliance with legal regulation allegedly intended to uphold justice. Crisis response refers to immediate action and strategies implemented to address and mitigate the impact of critical event or emergency. It involves planning, mobilizing resources, providing assistance, and communicating effectively to mitigate harm and to facilitate recovery. Unarmed crisis response, as an alternative to law enforcement, it is all about community, ordinary everyday people coming together to help and render aid to those who are unhoused, those with mental illness, emotional issues, and those in distress who struggle with drug addiction. There is a notable difference between law enforcement and crisis response. I went out into the community and asked a few members of the community what would be the best response to an emergency situation like the standoff on West Cross Street and or the deputy-involved shooting. How should law enforcement respond? Or should crisis response groups play a bigger role in de-escalating tense situations in our community? Kim Daly, who is a social worker and an Ypsilanti resident, said, "The police response to the West Cross Street standoff was totally inappropriate. I don't know if the police should have that level of militarized equipment. We need nonviolent crisis response groups like Care Based Safety, a nonviolent police team that responds without guns, pepper spray, and tasers. But city leaders refuse to fund Care Based Safety, and this is the result. Carol Smith, who lives in the neighborhood where the police standoff took place, the people in the neighborhood think the situation was handled poorly. The poor man was traumatized.
Avalon awarded low-income tax credits for the final phase of Hickory Way. Dan Meisler, Avalon Housing. Avalon Housing has been awarded low-income housing tax credits, which will bring in approximately $10 million in tax credit equity for the third phase of the Hickory Way Apartments campus in Ann Arbor. The Michigan State Housing Development Authority announced the awards in December, MSHDA. The tax credits will pay for about 60% of the total cost of the project, which will add 39 one-bedroom units to the existing 70 units at Hickory Way. Securing the tax credits will allow Avalon to move forward in pursuing the remainder of the funding needed. Depending on how that process goes, construction could start in the late summer or fall of 2026, with the project opening to tenants in late 2027 or early 2028. We're really excited to be able to add more local housing to help address homelessness in our community, said Wendy Cardi Saxon, Avalon's Director of Real Estate and Development. We have seen what a difference it makes on an individual and community basis. Other funding sources for the project include federal home and home ARP projects allocated through Washtenaw County, the City of Ann Arbor Affordable Housing Millage, a payment in lieu of taxes to the city that lowers the project's property taxes, Washtenaw County Brownfield Program, construction loans from the Huntington National Bank and Chelsea State Bank, and pre-developed funding from the Corporation for Supportive Housing. National Equity Fund is the investor limited partner. The City of Ann Arbor helped Avalon acquire the land by exercising its right of first refusal. When the previous owner sold the plot, the deed allowed the city to purchase it before any other buyer. The city bought the land and entered into a purchase agreement with Avalon at cost, which was approximately $260,000. When so many parts of a community come together, the federal level, the county board, the City of Ann Arbor, and our partners in banking and finance, we can do great things to address homelessness and make sure all of our neighbors have a safe place to call home, said Avalon Housing Executive Director Aaron Cooper. 24 of the new units will have project-based housing vouchers, meaning rents cannot exceed 30% of tenants' income. 20 of those apartments will be set aside for people directly leaving homelessness, and 4 will also be open to people who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. Avalon provides all residents access to support services to help them thrive, including help addressing food insecurity, on-site health care, and transportation to critical appointments, among others. When the first phases of Hickory Way opened in 2021, the rate of chronic homelessness in the county fell by 31%.
Title, Remembering Bob Marley on his 81st birthday. The subtitle is Messenger of One Love, One Heart, Peace and Justice by Will Shakespeare, vendor number 258. Robert Marley was born on February 6, 1945. If we do our math correctly, he would have been 81 years old now if he did not pass away on May 11, 1981. This year, the City of London has planned a big birthday party for Marley on February 6th. Across the globe, including some college towns like Ann Arbor, there will be some form of get-together at house parties in remembrance of the great singer, philosopher, and humanitarian. Robert Marley, who is known around the world as Bob Marley, is the first global superstar from the third world. He was born in a rural neighborhood known as 9 Miles in St. Anne Parish, Jamaica. His father, Norval Marley, was a white Englishman who was a supervisor of geographic agricultural lands in upland Jamaica. He was 50 when Bob Marley was born. Marley's mom, Sidella Booker, was a black Jamaican teenager when Marley was born. In order to avoid local and international scandals, the couple quickly got married but did not live together. Bob Marley was raised by his mother in a poor rural village. Marley did not have much contact with his dad. At the age of 12, Marley and his mom moved to Jamaica's largest city and capital, Kingston. Life was tough for Marley and his mom at Kingston's public house known as Trench Town. During his early teens, Marley learned to be a welder so he could help provide income for his family and help his mom. Marley got more interested in the music business. By the age of 16, he recorded his first song titled "Judge Not," which was well received in Kingston. Marley met a young musician, Bonnie Wailer, in 1962. Marley was about 17 years old, and Wailer was a young adult who was friends with Marley's mom. Later that year, they asked another young musician, Peter Tosh, to join them in a new band called the Wailing Wailers. Why did they call their band the Wailing Wailers? The name was chosen because they said that they were all born crying as they grew up in slums and ghettos of Jamaica, especially Kingston. Their songs' genre of preference was reggae. Their songs were a reflection of the poverty, deprivation, racism, and injustice of the 1960s Jamaica. The Wailing Wailers' first song, "Simmer Down," was number one hit in 1963 in Jamaica. At the time, Jamaica's dance music was fast frequency music called scuff. However, the Wailers' reggae song slowed the beat. The original Wailers released many influential songs. Through his music, Marley and his band members tried to develop visions of peace and freedom. 1966 was a pivotal time for the Wailers and Marley. It was the year the Wailers fully joined the Rastafarian religion. It was the year the Wailers began to grow their dress. It was the year that Emperor Haile Selassie visited Jamaica. Selassie was regarded as the black king who had been prophesied by Jamaican hero Marcus Garvey. Some Jamaican historians and documentarians believe that Bob Marley and many other Jamaicans became convinced that Selassie was Jesus Christ reincarnated. The Wailers and the Rasta elders believed that Jesus would return with a different name, and over time began to think that name was Haile Selassie. After Haile Selassie went back to Ethiopia, the influence of Rasta spread exponentially and rapidly. 1966 was also the year that Bob Marley met a Rasta woman by the name Rita. They got married the same year. Rita became one of the three female backup singers of the Wailers. 1966 was also the year that Marley decided to migrate and join his mother in the United States. He was employed at a Chrysler auto plant in Delaware, where his mom worked as an assembly plant union employee. He wanted to spend time with his mom and send earnings to his new wife, Rita, who still lived in Jamaica. After a few months, Marley left the job and the United States to continue his music and songwriting career in Jamaica. The Wailers felt exploited by the recording companies in Jamaica. Because Marley was an iconic and gifted performer with incredible stage presence, the musical group changed their name to Bob Marley and the Wailers. Luckily, in 1972, they were signed to a London-based recording company managed by Chris Blackwell, who was known in the European and United States music industry. Catch a Fire was their first album after signing the contract with Mr. Blackwell. Among the popular songs in Catch a Fire, which was released in 1973, were Stir It Up and Concrete Jungle. Another subtitle, Bob Marley After the Breakup. In 1974, the band broke up. Each member pursued a solo career. Bonnie Wailer went his own way, and Peter Tosh went his own way. Marley performed with a new lineup, still using the band name Bob Marley and the Wailers. Marley had his first international breakthrough in 1975, according to a Jamaican documentary. The collaboration with music executive Chris Blackwell meant that the reggae band from Jamaica had access to cutting-edge musical recording equipment. Bob Marley's hit song, No Woman, No Cry, came out of the Natty Dread album. The next year, in 1976, he released the Rastaman Vibration album. Both albums bore themes of poverty, slums, oppression, inequality, injustice, and resistance, which were commonplace in the third world. His message include dreams, hopes, unity, peace, harmony, and above all, love. By 1976, there was no doubt that Bob Marley had become an international superstar. He was in demand for concerts in the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, France, the the United States, and several more countries. Many reggae music lovers were discovering his older songs. On December 28, 1976, there was an assassination attempt on Marley's life. It happened in his house in Kingston, Jamaica. Marley, his wife Rita, and his manager were all shot. They survived. They were lucky. Marley moved to London at the end of 1976. Marley and his new Wailers Band members released a very influential album named Exodus in 1977. Its title song was written in response to the campaign slogan of Socialist Party leader Michael Manley. We know where we are going. In quote, Exodus is a partly vision and partly an anthem with a siren call to all the world to leave the wickedness of Babylon and return to the holy place in your Ethiopia. We know where we are going. We know where we are from. We are leaving Babylon, y'all. We are going to our father's land, he sings. In 1978, Marley visited Kingston. He brought the concept of reggae for peace and unity. The political disagreements and election campaigns got very violent in Jamaica. Marley wanted Jamaicans to see a symbolic show of peace and unity. What did he do? He gave a concert in a big arena, which ended with Socialist Party leader Michael Manley and Conservative leader Edward Siega, who both served as prime ministers, lifted their arms and shaking hands while Marley was standing between the two. It was an important gesture for a peaceful democracy. Siega said the following about Bob Marley after Marley's passing. In quote, I myself was a minister in the government responsible for art and culture. Bob Marley captured the popular imagination of the people. Marley internationalized Jamaican music. Bob Marley was successful because of his creative music. He captured public imagination. His songs had a message that transcended race, color, and creed. It dealt with the protest of a large section of the world, in quote. Michael Manley commented that Bob Marley's art was very significant. In quote, he said, he, Bob Marley, was one of the rare artists to come around in a generation. Bob Marley was able to internationalize his songs and message. Bob could sing about Zimbabwe and Trench Town. Robert Marley, according to Manley, here we mean Michael Manley, was one of the most articulate troubadours of the ghetto. His caring about social issues such as poverty, inequality, and injustice was unshakable and uncompromising, in quote. Bob Marley's final two albums were released in 1979 and 1980. Survival, released in 1979, had popular songs such as Zimbabwe and Africa Unite. and survival. Marley's last studio album, called Uprising, showcased Marley's belief that reggae music came out of Africa, and people like Marley polished the music and made it famous. Reggae was indeed a reflection of the stories of oppressed people in Africa and the African diaspora. And reggae, and Marley talked about root reggae a lot. When the end is near, music historians say that Marley's last concert performance was at Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on September 23, 1980. That was around the time he found out about his illness, cancer. The diagnosis showed that the cancer, which started on his foot, had probably spread to other parts of his body. And his managers canceled the rest of the United States tours so he could get treatment. Because of his religious beliefs, Marley rejected the amputation, which was recommended by his doctors. In the final stage of his life, from 1980 to 1981, he sought alternative medicine. It did not work. Treatment at a clinic in Germany did not stop the cancer from spreading rapidly. Marley prepared himself to die in his mansion in Kingston. But while trying to get back home, he passed on at a medical center in Florida, now known as the University of Miami Medical School. Marley's dead body was flown to Jamaica, where he received a state funeral fit for a national hero or a prime minister. They mourned and celebrated Bob Marley's life and death all over Jamaica. His music, his song lyrics were sung from every corner of the world. There is no question that Marley's funeral was a triumphant event, as mourners sang and danced to the melodies which brought hope and comfort to masses of the downtrodden and poor people across the globe. There is a line from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, in quote, "When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of a princess," in quote. Bob Marley was a global prince of one love, which Prime Minister Edward Siega said meant the vision of peace and unity during his eulogy in 1981. Bob Marley's musical accomplishments are staggering. He was posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1994. Marley's 1977 album, titled Exodus, was designated Album of the 20th Century by Time magazine in December 1999. Marley's song, One Love, was designated Song of the Millennium by the BBC. Marley continues to be remembered by people all over the world. Thank you, and have a nice day.
People in the Neighborhood, a column by Jim Clark, ground cover vendor, number 139. This is Rob's story. Rob is a friendly man, very easy to talk to, and loves light and clever conversation. I've known Rob for a few years now. His health is challenged and is exacerbated by suffering through homelessness. Rob is a talented DJ. I see him on the bus and in the library with his mixing program on his laptop all the time. He is a capable man, even with his health struggles. "Where were you born?" I asked. "I am from Dearborn, Michigan," Rob replied. "Did you go to high school?" I asked. "Yep, I graduated from Three Rivers High School in 1980. "Did you go to college?" I asked. "No," he said. "I went to a vocational school to be a sound engineer and a DJ." "What got you into DJing?" He said, "My mom. We were in the Grace Church Choir for 7 years. I got to help out on the soundboard. I've been a DJ for over 43 years now. I've done over 1,000 weddings and have been up and down the gentlemen's clubs on 8 Mile in Detroit," he said. "If you could go to college for free and study any subject, what would it be?" I asked. "I would go to Full Sail in Florida," he said, "and get a certificate in sound engineering. Engineering jobs can start at up to $96,000 per year," he said with emphasis. "Would it be easy to get a job after the courses?" I asked. "If I got a certificate, probably," he said. "It's a matter of having good ears. If you have good ears, you can still get a certificate. Those certificates pretty much just show you know the basics. A certificate means you have just enough skills to get a chance." "What kind of places hire sound engineers?" I asked. "Usually touring bands. I might find a studio to work for, but I would kind of like to go out on the road. It would be fun to travel and get paid," he mused. "But unfortunately, there's no opportunities here. I need to go to Vegas, but I don't want to leave because I like the friends I have here. But sometimes you have to make sacrifices to be where you want in life." "What about starting your own DJ business?" I asked. "I've had a couple of those. I'd rather find a place to work," he said. Then we pivoted. I asked Rob about his experience with homelessness. "What was life like for you before you became homeless?" Rob recalled, "It was okay. I was working at a club, doing what I do, just living at the time, trying to make ends meet. You know, just one thing after the other. I had a 4-year-old car, turbo with all-wheel drive. I was living with my best friend. He was living his life, I was living mine. We were working, driving, shopping, and taking in what life has to offer. Then it happened." Rob shared the moment his life fell apart. "You said your best friend passed away," I asked. Rob replied, "We went to South Carolina and decided to get a house. So, you know, if we didn't find someone to marry, at least we could help each other pay the bills. He passed away, and all of a sudden, all the bills were in my lap. I burned through my savings, and then crashed my brand new Chevy after being cut off in traffic. Then my sister passed away within 3 weeks after that. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that happened, and the next thing you know, I'm homeless." "All right, so what's going on now?" I asked. "Tell me about the last 2 years of your life." "It's been living in a tent and trying to make money by donating plasma. I'm surrounded by people with dangerous mental illnesses. I've had 3 surgeries and have had to recover in my tent. I can't really do a lot of physically intense work. There's not a lot out here for broken 60-year-old men." Then I asked, "Tell me about the last couple of days at your camp." "I haven't been there. I've been staying in the church's overnight sheltering program. The last time I went back to check on my tent, somebody took it out. Somebody took my tent and took all of my stuff out of it. All of my clothes are actually in a bag ready to go do laundry, so they just picked them up and took them. You know, I'm 5'6" and 170 pounds. There's not a lot of people who can wear my clothes. So, you know, whatever. I'm a little angry, but I'm getting over it." The clothing Rob was referring to were things he had gotten for Christmas from a local hospitality house. "Where are you with housing? Are the agencies helping you?" I asked. "I asked PATH where I was on the list, and they couldn't give me an answer. Then I found out I was not on the list. so finally I had to deal with it myself. They've got every little bit of useful idea and information they need about me, so I don't know. I guess with the kidney stones and the bad back and everything else, I must not be a priority. But still, I'm not going to let it keep me down. I've crawled out of the hole a few times. So, you know, this is just taking a little longer because I'm older. It is important to note that, like many others, Rob has been waiting for help from the government for months. He was acting responsibly when he was in South Carolina, working and paying bills. And then tragedy struck. Was it his fault his friend died? Was it his fault his car was wrecked? Was it his fault for having kidney stones? No, no, and no. So where is the state? This is what social welfare programs are for. So why are so many people waiting for months for help? Here is some more information about people recovering from surgery while experiencing homelessness. Post-surgical mortality and homelessness. People experiencing homelessness, PEH, are more likely to experience surgical complications, with one study finding they have almost 2 times greater odds of complications compared to housed patients, American College of Surgeons. Homelessness is an independent risk factor for developing infections and complications within 90 days of surgery, U.S. National Library of Medicine. Reports have documented specific cases, such as a woman in a Canadian tent encampment who passed away after being denied necessary surgery because she had no safe place to recover. New Brunswick Media Co-op. Then I asked Rob, "You had surgery recently. Tell me about that. What happened afterwards?" He said, "Trinity Medical, formerly St. Joe's, just released me. I had to wait for a bus to take me back to my camp. No ride, no motel, nothing. They didn't even let me spend the night." I asked him, "Are you recovering okay?" He replied, "I'm still bleeding."
Tommy Spaghetti, Sugar Man and the Origins of S.K. Rodriguez. Everybody knows Sugar Man, right? If you don't know Sugar Man, then perhaps you missed the greatest Cinderella story of the 21st century. Artist slash musician makes a record, record flops. Record company drops artist from label. Artist lives in relative obscurity for 30-plus years. Through an internet connection, artist discovers they have millions of fans overseas. Artist travels to foreign country and receives a hero's welcome. Artist makes triumphant return home. Artist lives happily ever after. What I just described to you was documented in the 2014 Academy Award-winning movie, Searching for Sugar Man, directed by Malik Bendigelul. I have to mention Malik's name because without him, this whole comeback story might have been missed by me. It is easy to identify with the artist Sixto Rodriguez, a.k.a. Sugar Man, especially if you're in the music business or if you just like it when the underdog wins. Maybe it was better that Sugar Man's album flopped commercially in the United States because it preserved his body for future use. We all know the downside of overnight stardom. Drug use, alcohol use and abuse, fast living, overconsumption of food, sex, and an early demise. The road after success is littered with youthful corpses as a reminder. Hendrix, Joplin, Morrison, Belushi. Sugar Man's 1973 record album, Cold Facts, had music that was danceable, but the lyrics were perhaps too honest for the average consumer. The song, I Wonder, while upbeat and danceable, pondered sex, pondered Vietnam, was written and composed in the early 70s vernacular. No wonder it didn't sell well in the United States in the 1970s. The title track, Sugar Man, integrated marijuana, tolerated cocaine, two subjects the Motown Records subsidiary was not interested in promoting. Let's fast forward now to 2026, and we have Sandra Rodriguez carrying her father's legacy like an Olympic torch. The two imposters, Chance and Fate, lured us together. Necessity wrote the screenplay. I was looking for a band to hire for a variety show, and after a brief phone conversation with Sandra Rodriguez, a.k.a. SK, it was clear that her experiences were beyond mine. I gratefully relinquished my position and invited SK to produce our In Loving Memory show, a tribute concert to the late great poet, activist John Sinclair. Wishing to avoid confusion in this article, I'm calling Sugar Man Rodriguez, and I'm calling Sandra Rodriguez SK. That's how they are referred to locally by friends and family. Collaborating with SK made me realize that I was in the presence of greatness and that I needed to conduct an interview with SK for Ground Cover News in Ann Arbor because Ground Cover has a loyal readership. Tommy Spaghetti, how did you get the moniker SK? SK. The initials of my name, Sandra Kennedy. Rodriguez first called me SK and I like it. How did you get into singing as a career? SK. I wrote and copyrighted 6 songs. When Rodriguez learned about it, he asked me to be his icebreaker and open his shows with my originals. My first performance was at Barclays Center in Brooklyn in front of 6,000 fans. Wow. What year was that? SK. 2013. Were you the icebreaker for all those shows in South Africa and Australia? SK. Yes, all the shows in Europe, Canada, United States, Australia. I've yet to perform in ZA. I just announced a tour trying to make it there. ZA? SK. Republic of South Africa. You were already in South Africa. I saw you in the movie Searching for Sugar Man. Was that before Barclays Center gig? Yes. In South Africa was before my dad knew I wrote and sang and played songs. And the other time he toured, I stayed in the United States and sent my daughters. They have been there several times. Bless that man. Are you excited about going to South Africa? About the possibility? Yes. Seems like a difficult thing to pull off. I would be nervous, but you've been there before. You played 4 sold-out shows in Australia in 2025. How do you stay relaxed while traveling such great distances and performing for large audiences? SK, I see it as a privilege and a pleasure and an honor to be there, and doing music is even more incredible. Sandra, I want to call you Sugar Mama. How do you feel about that? SK, not interested in being called that. My name is SK, or Sandra. By this time in our relationship, SK and I have become friends. Unwittingly, I got stranded on the east side of Detroit. I could have taken a city bus back home, 13 miles, but I've already walked 5, and I'm worn out. Knowing that SK lives somewhere on the east side, I give her a call, and she answers. The angel seemed to be on my side, so I press my luck. SK, I'm stuck at 8 Mile and Gratiot. Can you swoop me? In just a few minutes, SK arrives in a squeaky, clean, new-looking SUV. After I buckle the seatbelt, SK tells me, I want to show you something. Wasting no time, SK drives to the cash corridor, stopping at not one, not two, but 3 gigantic murals painted in Sugar Man's likeness, each mural depicting Rodriguez in a different guitar pose. This is a drive-by mural tour, so it doesn't take long to observe the murals. SK steers her SUV down an alley. We stop, and SK gets out of the car, unlocks, and opens a huge wooden gate. We are now in a fairy tale existence, looking at a stately home in Wayne State University's Woodbridge neighborhood. Sweeping my head from side to side, I gaze at the perfect concrete, the manicured grass, the stockade fence offering neighborly privacy and foliage. Imagine the shows we could put on here, states SK. This porch could be the stage. SK unlocks the door, and we enter the unoccupied house. Rodriguez bought this house for $100 in the 1970s. It was his lifelong project. SK is giving me the nickel tour, starting on the first floor. The walls look freshly drywalled. No art adorns them. Sanded hardwood floor is perfectly level. No furniture at all until we reach the second story. In the living room rests a polished black grand piano. Lifting the key cover, I sit down to play a tune while Sandra walks around, making sure the balcony windows and doors are firmly locked. My sisters want to sell the house. It's listed for $325,000. I want to buy them out. SK leads me into the basement. There on the floor, against the bricked wall, are tools, hammers, sledges, crowbars, saws, levels, all neatly aligned, perfectly spaced, like it's an exhibit at Greenfield Village at the Henry Ford Museum. From this evidence, it's clear that Sixto Rodriguez was a master craftsman. This house is symbolic of Rodriguez's music career, impressive and enduring. The three Rodriguez murals are not hyperbole. Rodriguez is remembered and loved by everyone around here.